Right then, so my name is Judith Bourne, and as I said to you at the very beginning, in 2015 I set up a symposia to gather together other academics who are researching the lives of first women lawyers. And that's because in around the turn of the millennium, I was helping with an exhibition at the Women's Library, and I was invited to come and pick out some material that they had, and I found in the archives these 18 boxes of uncatalogued material that all related to Helena Normanton, who was the first woman to make use of the Sex Disqualification Removal Act of 1919. And I had, in a previous life, been a barrister, and I had never heard of this woman at all. And there she was, just in these 18 boxes that nobody had even catalogued at that point. And I found that rather disturbing, and I picked out some material and we showed it in the exhibition. But I felt, I suppose I'm quite sentimental, I felt really quite upset that this woman who had really campaigned so much for women's equality had been reduced to these 18 boxes, and in fact they had been forgotten. Those 18 boxes had ended up at the Women's Library because when she died, her niece donated them to the Women's Library, and she literally just said, here are these boxes, do what you want with them. I don't know if the material's of any use, if it isn't, just bin it, which is just dreadful because it has some kind of historical importance and value, and it shouldn't have ended up in a landfill, which it didn't, thankfully, to the Women's Library. So this is how I found Helena Normanton. I was supposed to be doing a PhD on dowries, and if I tell you that I am an equity and trust and land lawyer, so you know the type of person that I am. Life is very black and white for me. Things are quite straightforward. There are no shades of grey. They follow a strict structure. You know, it's almost a bit like computing. You put in the problem and out comes the answer. So in fact, I had this PhD all lined up at SOAS, which was very, very straightforward. It was all to do with dowries and property. And I felt that I couldn't leave Helena Normanton sitting in these boxes. And so the then director of the library, Antonia Byatt, said to me, why don't you do your PhD on her? And so that's what happened. And then began this love affair with Helena Normanton. And I think everything that I say to you, you need to remember that I'm coming from a particular perspective. I obviously over self-identify with her. So just be wary of the things that I tell you. And remember that I'm not a historian. So this was a real labour of love because I'm a lawyer, I'm not a historian. So this was a very new type of study for me. And of course, it eventually led to me achieving my PhD at King's College, and also to me publishing a book on her. And then, of course, in 2015, I set up this symposia with the idea that it would unite academics, because I realised that on my own, I couldn't possibly research these women. There are just too many of them, and their lives are too varied for just one person alone to actually record what happened. So I really got everybody together. And since then, we have been meeting on this annual basis to look at first women lawyers. So who was Helena Normanton then? Who was this woman that I found in these boxes at the Women's Library? And as I've said to you, she was the first woman to make use of the Sex Disqualification Removal Act in 1919. Because the moment, and we'll come back to this later because it says a lot about her character, literally the moment that the Act was passed, she joined Middle Temple, she was admitted. So she becomes this role model, icon, figurehead, whatever it is you want to call her. She becomes really the pin-up girl of first women lawyers. And I think that has problems that we'll talk about at the end of this. It has real problems with how we deal with her and really what we take from her life. So like Carrie Morrison, Helena Normanton was a teacher by profession. She started her life really in very humble, she had very humble beginnings. She was born to a piano tuner and a mother who was first of all a milliner, and then later she would become a publican and then finally a boarding house keeper. Her parents clearly had a very unhappy marriage because they separated as soon as Normanton's sister was born. And then, so Helena was born in 1882, and her father dies 4 years later, quite mysteriously, just outside of Paddington station. She was on a Metropolitan line train, and he, I think, and again, I'm not a historian, and historians don't fill in the gaps, but I think it's quite clear that he killed himself. The police found the carriage of the train, the door open, his briefcase in there, and he was lying further up the track, dead from a broken neck. So I think Helena Normanton's, her really, the beginning of her life was really quite troubled. And of course, at that time, it was difficult to come from a broken home. It was quite unusual to have parents who were separated. And it was quite unusual to be brought up by your mother. So you can see that perhaps that's the start of her feminist roots, because she's brought up in this very female-dominated family. It's her mother who's caring for her with the help of her mother's sisters, so her aunts. So she's brought up in this very female-only household, and she has a sister, a younger sister. And she doesn't have that sort of Victorian ideal of the father under whose wing and protection you did everything. You know, she is literally just there with her mother. So she was born in 1882, her father dies in 1886. Her mother is very switched on. She has found a school in Wanstead which will take fatherless children and give them a proper education. But by the time Normanton, by the time the references have all come through, Normanton is too old. So her sister goes in her place. And Normanton really travels to Essex and then finally to Brighton with her mother doing different kind of jobs, one of them being a publican, which again perhaps isn't the background you would expect from the first women to join an inn of court. You might expect them to come from a very different class. So she's unusual for a lot of reasons immediately in her life. She's from a broken family, she's from a very female-dominated family, and she's from a class that isn't associated, I think, in that period, certainly not the bar, with the law. She's from the lower classes. And then when she's 12, she has this experience in a solicitor's office, which is probably lucky for the rest of us. Her mother visits a solicitor with a view to finding out about a mortgage, and her mother cannot understand what the solicitor is saying. And so the solicitor says to Normanton, he says, right, you explain it to your mother. And she does explain it. She explains it perfectly. And the solicitor says to her, oh, you're quite the little lawyer. And so she resolves there and then, or at least this is the story that she tells, she resolves, right, well, then I will be a lawyer. I will be a lawyer when I grow up. And of course, at this period, there are no women lawyers because women are prohibited from entering the legal profession. So she says that is the reason that she wants to become a lawyer, because of this experience. She says that it's an example of sex discrimination, because she says men would understand a mortgage arrangement, but her mother didn't have the necessary education. And I think that's probably not true. I think probably a lot of men, probably the majority of men at that time, wouldn't have understood a mortgage arrangement either. But she sees it as an example of sex discrimination, and that is what inspires her to become a barrister. But of course, she can't become a barrister at 12. A, she's too young, and B, it's not possible. Women are prohibited from joining the legal profession. So she does what many young girls do at that stage. She joins a school with a view to being a pupil teacher. So she enters Van Dean College in Brighton in 1895, and she becomes a pupil. It's called York Place at that point. And then in 1900, she becomes a pupil teacher there. And so in 1900, that's the year that she embarks on becoming a pupil teacher, but it's also the year of her mother's death. And I think that's probably quite significant, because then she really is quite alone in the world, although one of her aunts comes down from Liverpool to look after her and to carry on the boarding house in order for these girls to have a means of survival, of living. But in 1903, she achieves a scholarship at Edgehill College in near Liverpool. And this is a really important point for her because she goes, although she is now a qualified teacher, she goes off and she does further teacher training in Liverpool. So she's further educating herself. But it's an unusual college for a Brighton girl to have picked because Edgehill normally only took young women from their own catchment area. But she goes there and presumably, and again, I'm not a historian, so I'm filling in the gaps and that's not what you're supposed to do. I imagine she went there because it was a real feminist institution. You know, they what the majority of girls there were suffragettes. And I imagine that's why she went there. But again, that's speculation. I don't have any evidence for that. So she stays there for 2 years. She's quite happy. She's also quite articulate and forthright because she didn't like the food that was being served to the girls. And so she went and she advocated to the headmistress that in fact the food wasn't good enough. And as a result, the food was changed. It was better. It was called some sort of Merseyside fish. It was very sloppy and disgusting. But although it's a little incident, I think it does show that she wasn't afraid of taking on authority, and she acted as an advocate. She acted as an advocate for her fellow, for her peers. So it's quite interesting. And then she embarks on her actual teaching career. She begins in 1907 teaching in Liverpool. She also spends a period of time teaching in France, in Dijon. In 1907, she moves to Acton to be a teacher, and then in 1913, she moves to Glasgow. Now, that's quite a lot of chopping and changing for a young woman, and I think what we can gather from that is that she's quite restless. All her references for that time say that she's a wonderful teacher. She's really good with the children that she teaches, but she appears restless. Not only is she changing jobs a lot, and taking on more responsibility, but she's taking on different forms of study. So she takes on a history degree, she achieves a first as an external student from the University of London, and she also tries to take an LLB. But she says, if you read her CV, she says that she didn't finish it because during the exam she started choking and so she couldn't finish. Now we're going to come back to that incident a bit later on because I think there's a little bit of illness behaviour that's going on, and that becomes a challenge for us when we're looking at her as a figurehead of a movement. So we'll come back to that a little bit later. But certainly, she begins to become quite challenging towards the legal profession because by 1915, she is very active as really a suffragette because she is a member of the WSPU, and she does write that she longed to go to prison but she couldn't because she knew that if she did go to prison she'd have a criminal conviction and she wouldn't be able to become a lawyer. So she doesn't do anything too militant. She leaves the WSPU and she joins the Women's Freedom League, which of course they are the women who are responsible for the grill incident in the Houses of Parliament. If you remember, they chained themselves to the grill and they had to come along and chop it down to evict those women. So she's clearly very active within the women's movement. And she speaks at some of their Magna Carta events. So she's speaking within these particular groups. But also in 1915, she leaves teaching. And she takes on she doesn't leave it completely because she takes on quite a controversial job where she goes and she becomes a tutor for the Baron de Forest. Now, he's a Liberal MP, but he's a risky person to be associated with because he's a Jew who has converted to Catholicism. But he's also a man who is divorced and he's kept his children. So he's just a little bit risky in really in his religion and in his politics and in the way that he's living his life. So she takes on this job as tutor to these two children. And later on, she writes in a publication that she left formal teaching of history. She was a history teacher because she couldn't cope with the way that history teachers had to teach history to children. She said that she had no problem with the empire, And again, a little bit of a challenge because she says the empire is perfectly all right in places like Australia and North America and Canada, where there aren't any people. Well, we all know there were people there. But she says it's not all right in countries, for example, like India, where they people have this great culture and heritage. And she says that that's completely wrong. And she said that she couldn't bear teaching a history syllabus that spoke about the empire and the acquisition of India as being something great and good and brilliant. So she was going very much against public opinion at that time, because that isn't what the majority of people thought. They thought the empire was good. So she clearly is outside, not just in her choice of employment by being employed by the Baron de Forest, but also by her political beliefs. She believes very much in equality for women. We can see that from her membership of certain women's organisations. And she believes that the empire is in some circumstances wrong. And again, that's going against the political opinion of that time. So in 1918, in February, women get the right to vote. And at this point, Normanton has left teaching or being a tutor to the Baron de Forest, and she has become editor for a journal called India. And it's an organ of the Indian independence movement. That's what it's for. And she's become this editor of it. And so she's going very much against what normal public opinion is. Women achieve the right to the vote in February 1918, and it's against this backdrop that she makes this application to join Middle Temple. So we can see she is very good at knowing when the right time is. And so literally the moment that she achieved the right to vote, she then makes this application to Middle Temple. So Middle Temple hear her application to become a student member, and they reject it almost immediately. So it's rejected on the 21st of February. And the reasons they give for it is that they can't. They are prohibited from allowing women to enter the legal profession. And they say they're prohibited because of the case of Bebb and the Law Society, which is a case where four young women brought an action against the Law Society. They were demanding that they should be allowed to sit the preliminary exams to become a solicitor. And these women were rejected, even on appeal. So Middle Temple says that their hands are tied. They can't possibly allow Helena Normanton to enter as a student member because they have to follow Bebb. They also say that there was a hearing in the case of Bertha Cave that happened in 1903, where Bertha Cave applied to join Gray's Inn. And again, she was rejected because she was a woman. And it's not a case as such, because although she makes an appeal to the benches of Gray's Inn, and they sit in the House of Lords, they're not sitting in the House of Lords in its judicial capacity. They are sitting as an appeal tribunal to the Inns of Court. But in Helena Normanton's rejection, Middle Temple say, we can't admit you because of the case of Bertha Cave. And it wasn't really a case. So they're making it up a little bit as they go along. And they also say that they can't admit her because of the Solicitors Act of 1843, which again is hard to understand when, in fact, the bar at this point is really distinguishes itself from the junior profession, from the solicitor's profession. So again, it's difficult to know why they are using this particular piece of legislation that just doesn't apply to them. And I think we can take from that they just don't want to admit women. Now, whether they don't want to admit them because they are women is, of course, one answer. I would say the reason they don't actually want to admit women isn't just because of misogyny, but because they're terrified of competition. There isn't enough work at the bar at this point for the barristers that are there. So if they let in another half of the population, there's going to be even less work available to barristers. So I think that's what it's about. It's not really about misogyny, although there's an element of it. It's this terror of competition. That's what they're really, really frightened of. They don't want to let women in. Now, Helena Normanton doesn't give up like many women before her. She writes to the Lord Chancellor, and in fact, on the 10th of June 1918, she gets this audience with Claude Schuster, who is the permanent secretary to the Lord Chancellor. Now, this is really difficult to understand how she was able to get to see this man, because if I wrote to the Lord Chancellor, he wouldn't see me. So it was even less likely then that the Lord Chancellor was going to meet this teacher, this, well, sort of past teacher, this woman who's editing India. Now, again, just remember, I'm not a historian, and I am going to fill in the gaps here. Helena Normanton eventually marries the son of an MP, and I'm convinced, I have no evidence for it, but I'm convinced that she gets that meeting because of her connections. But again, that's just me making it up as I go along, so take it all with a little bit of a pinch of salt. But otherwise, I don't understand how she gets this meeting with Claude Schuster. It doesn't make any sense. And it also doesn't make any sense that Claude Schuster is so incredibly helpful, because she goes to him and she says, I've been rejected. What do I do? How do I appeal? And he actually, you can see it in her archives, he actually drafts the appeal for her. And not only does he draft it for her, but he tells her who she is to lodge the appeal with, all the individual judges. So he's unbelievably helpful. And remember, this is a civil servant who is working for a government who is completely anti-women lawyers. They do not want to let women into the profession. So I think we do have to wonder and question why it is that he is so helpful to her. So she does what he says. She lodges her appeal, and that appeal is heard on the 30th of January 1919. She doesn't understand, because she isn't told that her appeal has been heard, but in fact they have rejected her. So she writes again to Claude Schuster in early February, and she says, what do I do, because I haven't heard back from them. And he says, please come along and see me, come into my office. And she goes to see him, and there is no record of this meeting. There is definitely evidence that he says to her, come and see me on this particular date, but there is no evidence of the meeting in the National Archives, which is really unusual, because they recorded everything, absolutely everything, but there is no record of this particular meeting. Now, Normanton insists in 1952 that at this meeting, she sat with him and they drafted the sex disqualification removal bill. But as we heard from Mary last month, there's absolutely no evidence that that happened, and there's no proof that it happened either. But probably they sat and they discussed it, because certainly she doesn't bring what we would understand today as a judicial review. And I've always found it very difficult to understand why none of those first women lawyers actually formally challenged the legal profession in a court of law. And she was so feisty that I think that would have been her next step. And she doesn't do that. And that's all, I've always found that difficult to understand. So even though she doesn't bring a legal action, she carries on campaigning, and she's militantly speaking at public events. She's writing to the press. She's absolutely pushing for women's admission. Now, we know from Mary last month, the government introduced in July the Sex Disqualification Removal Bill of 1919. And literally in the same month that the bill is introduced, Normanton takes on a lease of Mecklenburg Square. And she's true to her working class roots. She takes on what used to be the Foundling Museum. It's now the Foundling Museum. It was the Foundling Hospital. She takes on the lease of that. It's an enormous building. And she has the idea that she's going to be a boarding house keeper. So she'll supplement her earnings at the bar by renting out rooms. But it is a catastrophe. The whole, it's a bit like the IT here. It just doesn't work. You know, the roof leaks. She can't ever get cleaners to come in, so she ends up having to clean the rooms herself and do the washing. It just doesn't work as a method. It's more work than it was ever worth. But what's interesting about that is that she puts down roots. She puts down roots in central London. Before that, she's a lodger in sort of Swiss Cottage in North London, but now she's actually taking a lease and she's really, really putting down roots. So she obviously knows that this piece of legislation is going to become law. By the 12th of November, she's sick to death of waiting. to be admitted as a student. So she writes to Middle Temple. Well, actually, she rings them up and she says, look, it's quite clear that the bill is going to become law, so please will you admit me as a student? And they write back to her and say, absolutely not. We can't do anything until that bill becomes law. So they just brush her off and send her away. But they change their tune on the 23rd of December when that bill becomes law, because they write to her and they say, we understand that you want to be admitted as a student. Please call today. But we just warn you, we won't be here on Christmas Eve and we'll be closed for the Christmas period. I don't know what happens, because certainly she doesn't go on the 23rd. And again, remember, this is a woman who has impeccable timing. She doesn't manage to get there on the 23rd of December, but they open the office up for her on Christmas Eve, even though they said they wouldn't do it. And so they admit her as a student, and we can see in her archives the receipt and her student card. So she makes history. She becomes the first woman to join an Inn of Court. She's the first person to use this piece of legislation. So she becomes now our figurehead of women lawyers. She is the first, and this is how she will always be known throughout the rest of her career. So she's victorious. She has done what she set out to achieve. She has become admitted to an Inn of Court. And by the following year, she's taken the first part of the bar finals, and she passes really very well. But because she doesn't have an LLB, she doesn't become the first woman to be called to an Inn of Court, as we heard last month. That honour went to Ivy Williams, who was able to, she was exempted from certain dining rules because she had an LLB, and so therefore Ivy Williams becomes the first woman to be called to the bar. So it all seems wonderful, doesn't it? Helena Normanton has achieved this wonderful first, but then it very quickly begins to go wrong. On the 12th of January 1921, she is called into Middle Temple, and she thinks, I don't know what she thinks, but she obviously thinks it's some kind of social invitation. But when she turns up, she is amazed, and she says that she becomes icily cold with fury, because what they do is they say to her, explain yourself, explain why you are in the newspapers, and explain why it is that you have been giving interviews to the press. And she says, well, I haven't done anything wrong. And she doesn't know how to answer it, because obviously she hasn't been forewarned. So she's caught unawares. And afterwards she writes that in fact she didn't understand the etiquette of the bar. She didn't realise that she wasn't allowed to speak to the press, and she didn't realise that this could be construed as self-publicising. And so she says that, you know, that she doesn't understand, and that because the rules aren't written down, they're not written down until the 1950s. She says that how is she supposed to understand? Now, we could say that this is a problem that many of those first women lawyers experience, where because they are women, they are outside of the profession, so they're not privy to these nuances of how legal professional life works. But I think, again, this is quite challenging in how we deal with her, because this is a woman who said that she wanted to become a barrister from the age of 12. She knew everything there was to know about the bar. So how is it she didn't understand that she shouldn't be speaking to the press and that it could be construed as self-publicising? So I think this is a challenge for us, and I think we can't just accept her explanation, although it sounds quite credible. And we do see these early women lawyers not understanding how the profession works and being stung by it. But I think that's probably being too generous to her. And I think we have to be wary about that, what that says about her. So I know I'm running out of time. Do you know, I could speak for hours on her, and I'm sorry. And I obviously do, you can tell that I think she's wonderful, and I do self-identify with her. Probably too much. So her legal career starts off really badly with this accusation of self-publicising. She passes her bar finals on the 26th of October 1921 with a third class, which is quite unexpected for a woman that manages to get a first class degree by extension from the London University. So it is, that's quite difficult to understand. But in 1921, at the same time as she passes her bar final, she also gets married. She gets married to this MP's son, Gavin Watson Clark, who is an accountant. He's not an MP himself. His father is this amazing MP who's quite a feminist. He's absolutely pro-women and equality and women having the vote. He's also very involved in crofting legislation. He doesn't like that in Scotland. And when he dies, he asks for a woman to bury him, so to hammer down his coffin, because he's such a believer in women's rights. So it's probably not surprising that she ends up marrying someone like this, someone who comes from such a feminist background. She does manage to find chambers. She joins Five Stone Buildings in Lincoln's Inn. At this point, it's not compulsory to do your pupillage. It's quite frightening. It is quite possible in this time for you just to go straight into court. So she has an address in chambers, but she clearly isn't quite happy there, because she writes to a Mr. Skinner of a different set of chambers to ask if she could join their set of chambers. And he says, "No, I can't possibly discuss you doing pupillage here, because my head of chambers would find it too upsetting," which is a little bit difficult to understand. So she's called in 1921, on the 17th of November, with nine other women. And again, it's really important to acknowledge she's not a lone agent. She is there with these other women. It's not just her who brings about this change. She's not the only one. And if we concentrate too much on her and use her as sort of the pin-up girl for first women lawyers, we ignore the struggle of other women, and we ignore really the work that they did in opening the profession up to women. And Caroline's going to speak next month about one of those women. She's not the first woman to hold a brief. That honour goes to Monica Geikie Cobb. But she does have her first case in 1922 on the 21st of December, which is a divorce case of Searle and Searle. So she's the first woman to appear in the High Court, and she's successful. She successfully gets the wife a divorce. But in the same year, she's blackballed from the Western Circuit. I think all the lawyers in this room understand how important it is for barristers even now to be a member of a circuit. It was even more important then. She's blackballed from joining the Western Circuit because they say that she's been self-publicising. Even though it hasn't been proved, they say that that's enough. That's enough just to be tarnished with it. And so they will not allow her to join. So she's not having a very good entry into the legal profession. She's the first woman to hold a doc brief. It's quite an interesting case. But again, when you read the newspaper reports, a little alarm bells go off about how professional she is in court. Oh, sorry, I touched the microphone. It's difficult when you look at how professional she is, because she treats it a little bit as though it's sort of a murder trial. You know, her language is quite complicated, and she argues the case for quite a long time. But anyway, again, that should give us a little bit of an alarm bell. And then in 1924, she does something really quite extraordinary. She goes off to America. She goes off on a lecture tour, which again is very risky for a woman who's not supposed to be self-publicising. Clearly, she needs the money, and the lecture tour brings in a lot of money. You know, it's really a very good way of getting money. But it's also surprising that she takes time out. You know, she's already in her 40s, so it's quite surprising that she would just go off and go to America and put her legal career on hold. So it's a little bit difficult to understand why she would do that, other than she needed the money, probably. When she comes back from America, her legal career is she's not dealing with the kind of cases you would expect for a lawyer to be in their sort of 40s and 50s. She's doing a lot of poor person's work. It's difficult to know why that is, whether it's because people weren't briefing her or whether perhaps those are the cases that she wanted to take on. But she is desperate to become a judge. She does everything. She writes to the Home Office, she writes to the Lord Chancellor, and they're not having any of it. They will not entertain her becoming a judge at all. So she doesn't manage to fulfil that particular ambition. And she keeps sort of courting controversy. She's very active in... she tries really to get Wallis Simpson to be accepted by the nation, and of course that just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, she's always slightly on the outside all the time. But she has very strong views, like Carrie Morrison on divorce. She believes in no-fault divorce. So again, she's a little bit too ahead of her time. And she is a member of various women's groups to do with divorce, but she manages to fall out with them and she sets up her own group for divorce. So again, she's challenging in the way she behaves. But in 1949, she becomes a King's Counsel with Rose Helbron. And so she's the first woman in England and Wales to become a King's Counsel, which is quite an amazing achievement. But of course, for her, it's too late. She's right at the end of her career, because 2 years later, she retires at the age of 69. I haven't talked about the other allegations of self-publicising, because they've been coming during her legal career, and they come even in retirement. On her retirement, she has a lunch with her friends, and she describes herself as the most senior practicing woman lawyer in England and Wales, and this gets reported into the Daily Mail. It's quite interesting that it's just the Daily Mail hasn't changed even now. Yeah, so this is a private lunch that she's having, and yet it gets reported on, and she is called in to Middle Temple to explain herself, to explain her behaviour. Why is she behaving like that? And she does everything to get out of having to go before Middle Temple. She says that she's in very poor health, she's crippled with arthritis, but she says, but please, if you see that I've gone and given other talks in other places, don't think that I'm putting this on, because I'm not. It's just that those are nice things, you know. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And again, she's using her health as an excuse, and she does that quite a lot during her career. So she dies in Sydenham on October the 14th, 1957, and she leaves about £22,000, which is about £540,000 now. And in her will, she actually leaves the majority of her money to establish Brighton, Sussex University. So that's where the majority of her money goes to, because she founds the university. Because she says that she was a daughter of Brighton and she wants to give back to Brighton, which is really very admirable, I think. So I promise you I'm going to stop in a minute. So in conclusion then, what does this narrative of her life reveal to us? What does it say about her? And I think the first thing it does is it humanises this history. There is a tendency, and I think I'm probably guilty of this, but there is a tendency to make these women into caricatures, that they are in some way these wonderful women who were just pro-feminist individuals. And they're not. I think, as we'll see in Caroline's talk next month, that in fact, they're not perfect, as none of us are perfect, are we? We are all individuals who react to things that happen. We're all multifaceted. So nobody is a perfect saint. In fact, saints like Thomas More, they're not perfect. You know, that's the whole point. They are sinners. So to go through this narrative of her life is very useful, because it gives some kind of texture and flavour to the lives that these women were living at that time. You know, what it was like, how difficult it was to become a lawyer. So it adds texture, it makes us understand what they were going through. And because a lot of this history has been lost, a lot of these women haven't been recorded, they haven't left any personal diaries or documents, so it's very difficult to piece together their lives. So by shining the spotlight on Helena Normanton, it's quite useful, because she illustrates the kind of struggles that these women had. This narrative also tells us a lot about our need for role models, that, you know, that life is quite difficult, and even in the legal profession, I think it's quite difficult often to achieve. For women, there's the glass ceiling, but there are other things in law, for example, class, race, all kinds of things that can hold us back, disability. And so these women are useful, aren't they, to use as role models, because they inspire us and they teach us about resilience. So they're really, really useful. But when we're using them, we shouldn't forget that they weren't saints, that they were imperfect, like we all are. But they are useful, certainly, in giving us something to aspire to. But there are dangers. There are great dangers, I think. And I think I've shown you some of those dangers. There's that problem of self-identification, that you give too much of yourself to the image because that's what you want it to reflect back on you. So there is a real danger of too much self-identification and placing these women on a pedestal, which of course they can't really, no one can survive being on a pedestal. And also because when we self-identify with them, we're uncritical. And Helena Normanton has a lot, really, to criticise. When I talk to her views on the empire, are really difficult to understand. You know, she has no problems with Native Americans or Aboriginals in Australia. You know, she has no problems with really their slaughter and the dissemination of their whole way of life. And that's difficult. That's really difficult to weigh up with how she feels about people in India. And that's very challenging. I think it's extremely challenging and probably is true of a lot of people at that time as well. But there are other challenges, I think, and I think you're all looking a bit tired, so I won't labour that point anymore. But I also think Helena Normanton's life tells us a lot about certain themes. One of them is misogyny in the legal profession. We all know it exists. But it's not really, I think in Helena Normanton's case and in all those first women lawyers, the fear from the bar wasn't just about women not being up to the job, it was about fear of competition. And that's what this history really tells us, that the legal profession was terrified of allowing the other 50% of the population to join in and compete with them, because there just wasn't enough work to go round. So it tells us a lot about the fears of the profession. Her life also tells us about class. When you read some of the other women's comments on Helena Normanton, they speak about her as being blousy and common, really horrible language. And that really reflects, I think, how people felt about people from the lower class then, and also about how people feel about people from the lower class now. I don't think it's just confined to that point, to that time. And it tells us about women lawyers at that time being pigeonholed into certain jobs. So Helena Normanton, a lot of the work she did was petty crime and family work. And of course, a lot of women find themselves in those kind of that kind of legal work even today. But it also tells us about a negative narrative that's often attached to first women lawyers. So Helena Normanton is heralded as the pin-up girl for first women lawyers. But then she goes through this horrible time of being constantly accused of self-publicising. And I think that's often what happens to pioneers. They have to be knocked down. We can see that all the time in the press. And so really her life story tells us a lot about how people are treated today when they do something quite unusual. And also her life tells us a lot about the fact that when I found her in the early 2000s, I had never heard of her, and which is really surprising for someone who had done an LLB and who had been to the bar, and yet I had never, ever heard about her. So this is a forgotten history, and we need to ask ourselves why these women have been forgotten. And they've probably been forgotten because they're women, perhaps. But we can talk about that in the discussion. So my daughter, when she was six, she's older now, she asks, why do these bunch of dead old women matter? Why are they important? And they really are important. And that's why I desperately wanted to do this lecture series. They really are important because, of course, women increasingly are holding quite high positions in the law, and over half of all women law under, I'll start that game. Half of undergraduates are now women. So we have this real influx of women coming into the legal profession. And these women need to understand that really 100 years ago, they weren't able to become lawyers, and they have come a very long way in 100 years. And so they can't expect discrimination just to have disappeared. That in fact, they need to recognize it in order to move forward. So these bunch of dead old women really do matter. They really are important because we need to understand our history. This history links us to the present, and we can understand the present if we understand the past. We can understand where we are today. So these women are really, really important, and they encourage us to take the long view. And of course, they inspire us, and that's really important. Anybody who inspires my students is welcome. Is welcome in my lectures, so that's brilliant. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much for listening to me. I could go on for hours and hours and hours, so thank you. Thank you very much.